This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Major, commissioning editor here at The Independent, and this is Double Take, a podcast in which our writers come into the studio to read and discuss one of their opinion pieces. It could be their weekly column or something from the archives that shines some light on this week's news. This week we're joined by Matthew Norman, who will be reading and discussing his piece, There's Only One Way Out of the Russia Probe for Donald Trump. Also, as a little bonus this week, after we've been talking about Trump, we'll have a little chat about fixed odd betting terminals, of which Matthew has first-hand experience.
A day before the Russian collusion crisis took its most dramatic turn, so far, Donald Trump typed his most gratifying tweet, so far. What he typed, to be precise, was the most pleasing two-word phrase in Twitter history. It offered such compelling reason for hope that it deserves recording with pedantic accuracy. At 7:17 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, on Sunday, 29th of October, 2017, the 45th president obliquely referred to the charges against three campaign team members made public the following day. The phrase concluded a quartet of tweets of crescendoingly deranged hysteria in which the tangerine blowhard tried to deflect attention to long-since debunked allegations about Hillary Clinton, those emails flogging uranium to Russia. In block capitals, he addressed it to no one, other perhaps than God. Do something! In a way, an odd way admittedly, one admires the honesty. He didn't mean to be honest, as if that needs saying, but his subconscious cut through the crap and guided those tiny fingers to reveal how cornered, scared and despairing he feels. This was an almost animalistic scream of terrified rage. It read, with a ritual shout-out to the power of wishful thinking, like the scream of a dying animal. The formal explanation for his agony came a day later with the first concrete results of Robert Mueller's investigation into his campaign's dodgy dealings with the Russians. By conventional standards, foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos' plea of guilty, lying to the feds, and charges of money laundering denied by one-time campaign chief Paul Manafort and his business partner Rick Gates are sensational. In this context, they are probably Mueller-light. The flipping of Papadopoulos and prosecution of Manafort looked like a violent shake of the tree to find who higher up the chain topples down begging to cooperate to save themselves. If these are the first baby steps on a long and winding road to perdition, what is at stake is something far larger than Trump's survival as president. It's been brewing for years. What we may be about to witness is the decisive war for ownership of the truth. The exact details of how Trump's campaign colluded with agents of a hostile foreign power to influence a presidential election will be disputed, opaque, and confusing to the layperson. Saving a full confession from Donald Jr. or Jared Kushner, and probably even then, Trump will obfuscate, lie, and deny. Hoping to create a Russian riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, he will throw up smokescreens. He will try to brazen it out and keep his approval ratings from a fatal collapse by bamboozling the American public. This is how he won the White House. Harder than ever to compute, though this is, 1 year ago, millions of non-partisan Americans decided he and Hillary were as bad as each other and reluctantly voted for the one who wouldn't bore them to death. The question now is whether enough Americans will do the same with the Russian collusion scandal and wearily wish a plague on both their houses. The answer may turn less on the quality of evidence Mueller presents than its perception. Trump's room for manoeuvre is limited. Smearing Mueller hasn't helped. He cannot coerce him. Having shied away from sacking him before, he cannot sack him now without provoking a constitutional crisis which, even at his 5 a.m. at Mar-a-Lago craziest, he couldn't imagine being able to contain. He could shut up in the hope that Mueller, having nothing more lethal up his sleeve, was using yesterday's charges as a bluff. But they almost certainly weren't, and Trump isn't well suited to holding his tongue. He could run the idiot defense that goes, if I was colluding with Moscow, how could I have been stupid enough to invite the Russians to hack Hillary on live television? But within hours of sacking Mueller's predecessor, Jim Comey, for official reasons unconnected with his investigation, he went on live telly and blurted that it was the Russia thing all along. Running the idiot defence is a big problem when your own chief of staff calls you a effing moron. The only effective weapons left in Trump's arsenal are the gift for using bluster and aggression to fool too many of the people too much of the time, and the fruits of his collusion with Rupert Murdoch's media empire. Fox News continues to propagate the myth that Hillary should have more to fear from Mueller's investigation, while a leader in the Wall Street Journal calls on Mueller to resign. I have studied Murdoch's black ops intently for 30 years, but this whoring out of a great and dignified newspaper seriously shocks me. What it plainly portends is an earthly version of a popular sci-fi trope. You may remember it from a Doctor Who story involving that Murdoch doppelganger Davros, or from Benedict Cumberbatch's Marvel Universe debut as Doctor Strange. In each, the monster's ambition was to destroy reality itself. In this version, the bad guy's motive isn't the nihilistic craving to destroy everything, but the self-interested imperative to save Donald Trump. To that end, he now relies on his and Murdoch's time-honored capacity for steering credulous minds into a parallel world of altered perceptions, where truth is falsehood and falsehood truth. If that fails, if, as Mueller peels away the onion, his approval ratings plummet from the historic lows of this week, one coming Sunday morning, Trump could tweet an even more exquisite two-word phrase. I quit.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Thanks for coming in, Matthew.
My pleasure, Kirsty. Nice to see you again.
You too. Russia, Trump. I've lost track.
I know.
Where
I know.
Are we?
This is the danger. This really, I wrote the piece I just read. I deliberately steered away from exploring all the detail because it's very finickety. It's quite boring. It's difficult to follow for everyone. And the point I'm making is that wherever we are now, this will be won and lost by perceptions, not by facts, not by evidence. Unless, of course, Robert Mueller gets a signed confession from one of the people closest to Trump that implicates him, or unless Trump, you know, has a brainstorm and confesses. Otherwise, as with most things in politics and elsewhere, it's a battle for the public relations and perception, and that's where the battleground is.
You wrote a really good piece the week before as well, talking about Trump and his love of the JFK files, because it fits into this whole narrative of whatever you learn and whatever comes out, it's not real. Yeah. It's fabricated.
Yes. I mean, painting himself as the enemy of the conspiracy theory was an amusing departure for the man who launched his political career on the back of the nonsense about Barack Obama being born in Mombasa and his parents inserting a birth announcement into all the Honolulu papers on the off chance that 45 years later, this black baby would grow up into a presidential candidate in a foreign country. So, but you've got to admire the chutzpah with Trump, as so often. But yes, exactly. So this is now what? As I said in the piece, I am exactly as old as the conspiracy theories about John F. Kennedy, because I was born the day he was buried, and you can see what I look like. That's how old this is. Look, behold, right?
This is how long it's been going
this
on
This is
for.
How long. This is what time has done to this newborn baby. Look at it. Right, 54 years nearly. And still, so the conspiracy theories about JFK were born pretty much the day I was born, which was 3 days after his murder when he was buried. And you know, despite these documents apparently not showing any reason to doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, that it wasn't the CIA and it wasn't Lyndon Johnson and it wasn't Moscow and it wasn't Fidel Castro, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter, right? So, you know, this is how old the normalization of altered reality is so far as facts. You can't persuade people who believe something, however crazy. The harder you try, it's like one of those knots. The harder you struggle, the tighter it gets. Now we have a battle for another, the survival of another American president. We know, we think, you know, this is one of those things, as Donald Rumsfeld might have put it in his poetic treatise on knowledge. We know, or we think we know, that Donald Trump's campaign colluded with agents of the Russian state. That appears to be plain. He went on television at one point and said, invited the Kremlin to hack Hillary's emails, right? Now, as I said in that piece, the idiot's defense there is, if I was doing that, if I was colluding, I couldn't be stupid enough. What kind of idiot would go on television and say it? But if he is an idiot, as most of us believe, or an effing moron, as his chief of staff, General Kelly, called him, he would do exactly that, as he did, in fact, with Jim Comey. 2 days or a day and a half after firing Comey with this nonsense about it was fired because of his treatment of Hillary Clinton, which is what got Trump elected, he goes on television and says, oh, this Russia thing's been driving me mad. You know, so he is an idiot. He might be clever in some spheres. Lots of people who make a lot of money are dunces, I think, in other spheres. He might have a very narrow intelligence, but really he's an idiot in this sphere. So he can't run that defense. So the defense he can run, he can only defend himself, assuming that there is collusion, as appears very plain, from masses of evidence. I mean, of those 7 or 8 people involved in his campaign at various times, including the one charged yesterday, Manafort, Paul Manafort, was the head of his campaign. Now, that's not somebody, and lives in Trump Tower, apparently at either for nothing or at a peppercorn rent. Now, there's not a lot of distance that Trump can put between him and Manafort. So these people had connections with Russia, or Manafort's been charged with offences dated much earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
But that establishes, you know, that he's a money launderer, or Pierce is charged with money laundering. You know, we know Donald Jr. met with somebody promising dirt on Hillary's campaign, an email to say, if that's what true, I love it, and all that, in Trump Tower, possibly a floor below his father at the time. But I mean, you know, there are always ways of obfuscating. But what we think we know, we're fairly sure we know, that campaign at a high level colluded with the Russians, possibly with WikiLeaks, to damage Hillary Clinton. And in an election that turned on a few thousand votes in a few states, I mean, literally in the Rust Belt states of Minnesota and Michigan and other states, enough electoral votes turned on tiny fractions to mean that anything decided it. Loads of things decided it.
And
one
also
of which,
Facebook, right? May or may not, at some level, high or low, Russia was involved with the Trump campaign, but it definitely placed targeted ads on Facebook.
Well, there's no question, I don't think, there's no serious question that Vladimir Putin and his people and the people working to Vladimir Putin, or doing what either his express bidding or doing what was known in Hitler's time as working to the Führer, which really means doing what you know the Führer wants without having to get him to sign off expressly, that Vladimir Putin's preference between the two was massively in favor of Donald Trump. Hates Hillary Clinton, blames her for encouraging democracy in Russia and potentially weakening his hold on power. And for her, what she said was Secretary of State about the you know, invasion of Crimea, and you know, loathes her, and a lot of people think that she, you know, her strong anti-Russian rhetoric and insistence that she'd introduce a no-fly zone in Syria is the kind of thing that could steer us towards World War III. Seems a bit fanciful, but you know, certainly as far as Putin is concerned, Donald Trump, who you know, apparently supposedly hinted at lifting sanctions placed on Russia since the Ukrainian colonization, whatever you call it, hinted at lifting those. So we know the Kremlin, but the feeling is that they didn't think that he could win, and that the aim of this wasn't to make him win, because that was too impossible a goal. The aim was to destabilize American democracy, which God knows they've certainly done. They've made a laughingstock of American democracy. You know, because we know that the fake information, the fake news that they were propagating, the smearing of Hillary through WikiLeaks, which appears to be connected to Russia. We know that in an election that turned on one of many tiny things turns it unquestionably without Russian interference. We have a different president.
And when you talk about disrupting democracies, I feel like when we're talking about North Korea, actually we're kind of having the wrong conversation, because nuclear deterrent means that the probability of nuclear war is very, very little. But the probability of cyber warfare, which I don't think many people are talking about, A, has happened, B, has no mutually assured destruction, so you can go as hard as you want to. And I wonder, why
I
do you think
brilliant point. I
people
think
aren't making
right.
that?
People are terrified of North Korea, I think, because there is a perception that you have two crazy people up against each other.
Mm.
And I always thought, you know, with something like Team America World Police and their depiction of Kim and the Korean leadership, and that there was a literal danger of laughing yourself to death because you don't take them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with Trump. Because it's so comical, so grotesque, so absurdly larger than political life as we know it, you just sort of dismiss it as a cheap joke until you wake up to see a mushroom cloud, you know, in the distance. But you're absolutely right. I think that the feeling is that actually the North Korean regime is entirely logical, in the same way as Saddam or, you know, any other dictatorship. Everything it does is for self-protection. They've seen mm-hmm. America go into Iraq, which wasn't armed with nukes. And they think the only way to protect themselves, and they're probably right, is by having nuclear weapons. But they are aware that if they use them, they will all die. And by and large, people don't vote for their own, you know, vaporization. Cyber warfare appears to be the future of warfare. You know, I mean, you only have to go on an underground train or a bus to see that people are entirely dependent now on, you know, computer technology. Psychologically, you know, it is. Countries even more so. You can cripple a country if you can write a line of software that cripples a country, you own the world.
You can elect a government.
You can elect a government, you can destroy a candidate, you can turn off the lights, you can destroy the transport system, or you can turn off air traffic control, you can clear the, you can do anything, can't you? There was a Sherlock episode with Moriarty in the Tower of London.
Yes.
In which, you know, and he was advertising the fake claim. Well, I don't want to do spoilers if you haven't seen it. I think it's called the Reichenbach Falls, isn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, who owns the software owns the world. You know, everything now depends on software. So if you have the cyber warfare capacity to knock out your enemies, you've won before
but
you
even
start.
In terms of perception, it's not as,
exactly.
You know, it's not even crypto security. It's who controls your Facebook feed, who controls your news, which
exactly,
is the point
exactly.
you made.
I mean,
your
it's
piece.
Always been the case that information is power. It's a cliche that goes back centuries. Now, the information, the source of the information is, if that is controllable with other software, cyber attacks, I mean, that is clearly the future of warfare.
And that's what Trump and his friends on the right of the media in America, especially the far right, like, you know, people like Alex Jones, is
I mean, we're talking about the right that's so far there that you don't understand why the man's at liberty mm-hmm. with Alex Jones. This is someone Trump watches and is influenced by.
Yeah.
I mean, he is just, you know, you couldn't put on that kind of psychosis, you know. But he has, you know, millions of people watch him, and the slightly more sophisticated, then you get Breitbart, and as you get more and more sophisticated, then you get to Murdoch.
Did you know Breitbart have the largest social media reach out of all news agencies.
Yeah.
That's more than the BBC, the Independent, the Guardian, Breitbart.
I know. And I've been
Isn't
watching.
That terrifying?
And that's another. Well, it is. I mean, it's another laugh. I've been reading Breitbart for years since it began and laughing at these idiots, you know, reading the comments and thinking, thank God these people are so outre and so wild that they're never going to be in the mainstream of politics. And here they are running the world. You know, it's a most horrendous slow motion car crash that they've steered us into. But, you know, again, we underestimate the power. This is what we do, the sort of liberal or metrocentric people like us and Washington and London. We don't have any feel for what's happening out. This is how we lost Brexit. This is how Hillary lost. We just don't feel that rage and that, you know, that spite and that that frustration and that disappointment and that nasty, brutal, racist urge that is shaped, you know, that's turned England and Britain and America into the sort of transatlantic confederacy of dunces in the last 18 months.
And it's that blind rage which allows people not to see the truth for what it is and to accept the information that feeds that rage. So with Trump, for example, they'd say, well, I'm sure he hasn't done anything. Well, you know, it's the establishment is rigged against him.
Yes,
and it's that
exactly
that as narrative.
As if, you know, because being a son of a multimillionaire, multi-billionaire, he's not part of the establishment, the president of the United States. He's an outsider without any power. Of course they do. I mean, it's a kind of collective act of will between the conscious and the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to believe it. They have created. You know, I was talking to someone a few months ago, and they said, well, the truth now is what you choose to believe. This is probably serious, unironic thing. So the truth, they are living in an alternate universe from some of us, or we are living in another universe from them. We believe that we are looking at the truth. We know that because of our journalistic training, because of our education, because of our outlook, it's not that we are capable of, we have a compulsion to discern fact from fiction. We can't help it. We may be partisan, we may lean politically to slightly to the left or the right or whatever, but we, as journalists, we cannot just peddle lies. We automatically know how to sift truth from falsehood, and there are millions of ways. Anyone who's, you know, been in higher education, that's what it's about, really. It's teaching you how to think or to how to discern.
But in a sense, it taps into it's not just saying, oh, we've created this narrative which it is a falsehood which you public believe. Actually, what someone like Trump has done is to say, I'm not this narrative, but I'm going to fit myself into a narrative which you understand, which is that you get messed about by people in power, by capital. And he's fit himself into that.
And you have to say...
It's a left-wing argument in many ways, isn't it? It's an anti-neoliberal...
It's either left or far right. That sort of rabble-rousing, you know, National Socialists.
Yeah.
We don't think of them as socialists, the Nazis. But, you know, feeding on resentment, stoking it, really. It's either the revolutionary left or the fascistic right, I think. And he obviously belongs to the fascistic right, so far as he belongs to anything. I mean, he's slightly hard to pigeonhole because he doesn't, you know, he's only really about himself, obviously. And he could have run as easily as a Liberal Democrat if he thought that would get him the power.
Yeah, I mean,
or the attention rather than the power. So and the narrative he created, and you've got to say, you know, how much you loathe him, and we all loathe and fear him. He has done it quite brilliantly. You know?
So what do you think will get him out of power?
Well, the point of the piece I'm writing today is, as I said, this will be won and lost on the perceptions. It will be muddied. These waters, they're already muddy enough. It's already very fine detail. Someone met someone else who knew someone who may have been briefed by the Kremlin. You know, it's not, unless there are whatever the cliche is, the silver bullet, the smoking bullet.
The smoking gun.
Or the silver bullet.
He's not a vampire.
No. He's the colour of, no. Unless there is that evidence, which you slightly doubt, then it's about, look, everything for him, as with most elected politicians, depends on the people, on his approval ratings in this case. Obviously, we have seen a collective act of cowardice from the Republican Party these last years, before Trump, but even more dramatically since, on a scale that, you know, I saw the film about Armando Iannucci's film about the death of Stalin recently.
Oh, I really want to go see that. Is it all right?
It's good.
The trailer
but
I'm a big fan of Iannucci.
I'm a huge fan of Iannucci, and I don't think I think it's good, but it's not as funny as you would. Anyway, that kind of sycophants, you've got all these apparatchiks, Malenkov and Molotov and Khrushchev and all these Politburo guys around him. Even when he's lying on the floor, stricken in a pool of his own urine, they are terrified of him, right? And it's quite good at satirizing the way that they change their opinions, just preempting what they think he might want them to think or say. But outside of that, these people had the excellent excuse that if they diverted in any way from the line that Stalin would have wanted them to take, he would kill them or exile them to the gulag or whatever, right? They were in fear of their lives and their families' lives. The people in the Republican Party are only in fear for their jobs and their incomes. But they have behaved towards Trump, most of them, with exactly the same slavering, craven sycophancy that we normally associate with people around dictators, proper dictators, not would-be dictators, people who could have you killed by raising an eyebrow at some hood by the door. So, but the only reason they do that is because it's in their interest. Now, the moment Trump's, this week, two polls, in each of them, his approval ratings at another record low, one at 38, one at 35%, both way below any president before him at this stage of their first term. So the minute, and it's falling all the time, he's losing uneducated or whites without higher education and independents, core constituents of his base. But the moment that gets to 30, the moment that Donald Trump is more likely to cost them their congressional or Senate seats or their seats in the House, then they turn on him like ravening wolves and tear him to pieces.
When's the next election?
There are midterm elections in a year.
Okay, so if...
carries on, right? Okay. He's gone from 46 to 36, let's say, in, what is it, nine months? Just over nine months. And these things don't stop. It's a gradual erosion. Let's say in a year or 6 months, he's at 28, 30. And George Bush at his worst, at his lowest sort of ratings, after Iraq was revealed to be a fraud and a catastrophe for everyone. If he's at those ratings, if the danger then is not that by attacking him, they suffer a primary challenge, so someone challenges them from their own party and removes them before those midterms, if the danger then is that by not attacking, by staying loyal, they will lose to a Democrat, even in safe Republican strongholds, then they turn on him with the same ferocity that they've sucked up to him or you know, been cowed by him. So that's why the perception with this is more important than the evidence. If it is presented in a way, if it seeps, it won't be someone saying, oh, look, you know, he met Igor Grigoryev, and, you know, 728 Gorky Park. It will be a slow osmotic, it'll seep into the consciousness. And if it is presented properly and coherently enough, that it just strips away another, you know, gradually, percent by percent, until his approval ratings is so low, until the embarrassment is such that the Republican establishment finally feels empowered to turn on him, then he is absolutely ripe for impeachment or removal under the 25th Amendment as unfit, or the pressure is such and the position is so hopeless that he walks away. But I don't think that comes down to one piece of evidence or one prosecution. I just think it's all about approval ratings.
And another thing which has taken quite a long time, and I know this is something else you wanted to chat about today.
Yeah.
Fix our bet terminals. It's been a long campaign.
Yeah, well, this is one of my things, because I've had problems with gambling all my life since I was tiny, stealing from my mother's purse to play.
When did you put your first bet on?
I remember a Brighton Pier on a fruit machine at about four. And then I think I had a winning bet on the Grand National not much later. So then my whole life I was obsessed with fruit machines and dogs and horses and, worst of all, roulette. And I was a young man, just to get my first job, I blew a couple of months' pay in a night in a casino in France. And from then on, I stayed out. Because in those days, it was quite hard to gamble here, as it should be. You had to be a member of a casino. You applied, it took a few days, you were vetted.
And were they everywhere?
You couldn't walk off the street. No, there were very few. So anyway, and because of that, I had this wonderful protection that when I was in this country, if I didn't join, I couldn't go. I just simply couldn't go. So I was fine. And then in 2003, I went into a betting shop in Bayswater in London to have a bet on a dog or a horse or whatever. And I saw this terminal. in the corner. It was on William Hill. I remember it as if it was yesterday. And you could put £20 notes in and play roulette in a betting shop. And of course I did. I got hooked briefly. And I wrote, I've been wrong about everything. More wrong than almost anyone. I've been wrong about Brexit and Trump winning and millions of things. But this is not humble bragging or boasting or anything, because anyone who suffered or who is prone to a problem with gambling, particularly roulette, knows that this is, I wrote this piece in The Guardian, it was a month after they appeared. This is under Labour. Mm. Tessa Jowell was the...
Did they ease up the regulation on it? Under Labour or something?
Labour allowed this. Anyway, I wrote this piece saying, I know, as someone who's had a problem with gambling, that roulette, with its massive rewards, right, 36 to 1 on a number.
So what does that mean? So you put tenner on and...
You win 360 if your number comes up, right? I know that this isn't just a... This is the crack cocaine of gambling, this game, right? Sort of cheap phrase. But it is. You can get hooked very quickly, and once you're hooked, you are in real trouble with roulette. I went as a five-year-old again to Blackpool. My father's auntie Lily, we went to stay with her. I was tiny, and I was put to bed, whatever, and the whole night I was up because I could hear this ivory ball clicking in her sitting room. And she was a woman then in her 70s, and she spent her whole life trying to work out a system to beat roulette, like thousands of others for hundreds of years. Of course, it can only be done in another parallel world where unlimited stakes. I won't bore you with that. I have seen, it's a cliche that the casinos of Europe are full, or were full, of these old grand duchesses with zircon rings. They'd sold all their diamonds, and all they lived only to play roulette. Mm. This is a wicked, wicked game once you get hooked. You know, it really is, for various reasons, psychochemical, reasons, endorphins, adrenaline, whatever. Dopamine, whatever the reasons are. And this is the worst of all gambling. This is crack or crystal meth or whatever the most addictive drug of the day is. So I wrote this piece and I said, this is going to be a massive problem. The problem with these politicians, Labour politicians, perfectly well-meaning, sort of, they've never been in a betting shop. They've never been in a casino. They don't understand that what they're playing with something really dangerous here, just for a few quid for the Treasury. You know, it is, suddenly, then more and more of these things are allowed. Suddenly, bookmakers are buying out every empty shop on the high street. Not because they, not because their people want to bet on horses anymore, which is, fairly comparatively harmless. At least you can study the form. At least you have a chance of beating them. You can't beat the immutable odds of probability on the roulette wheel. It will take, the house will take 3.6% over time. You can't win.
Mm.
You're not gambling to win. As Dostoevsky said, a proper gambler, you're gambling to lose. It's a kind of sadomasochistic thing. Suddenly, they're everywhere now. They're every shop that falls vacant because it costs them nothing. They put one member of staff in, four of these machines in. They're more than half their profits are now made up. I've seen people, in the early days, I met some guy, an Albanian guy. He said he'd been saving up for 2 years to take his family to Tehran. He'd done it in an hour and a half in this machine. There were little old ladies who'd just blown their entire pension, this was unique in my long and cynical history of studying British politics. This was a policy designed to increase the sum of human misery. And also, this is a regressive tax on the poor in the same way, because there are millions of studies, but the poorest areas have the most of these shops, and there are people who can barely afford to feed themselves and their families who are playing these machines. And I don't understand. It can only be ignorance and stupidity from the Labour Party that allowed them to make this mistake.
And now, isn't it that they've reduced the amount you can bet, so they're still
in the
shops?
Well, they're going to. I don't think it's clear yet. It's something between £2 and £50. But it's a powerful lobby, the betting industry. And there's this guy, Philip Davis, who I think tried to sue me once, so I better be careful what I say about him. But he is quite an effective lobbyist on there. I think he worked in a betting shop or ran one or something. And of course, it's exactly like the tobacco industry. They claim it's harmless, as the tobacco industry did with cigarettes and the connection with lung cancer. And then they put up these stupid little signs. Now, you know, so, oh, these terrible bloody advert. You watch a, you know, it's not just roulette machines. I mean, you watch any sporting event now, and that bloody Ray Winston every 10 seconds. Every advert now is for online casinos, mm-hmm. or betting. You know, online betting thing. You know, oh, we're an army of millions all around the world. We watch. It's quite sinister. It's sort of Orwellian. We watch everything. We're millions strong. Well, I bet responsibly. We bet 365. And you think, oh, make this cease. So, I mean, that seems to be completely unregulated. So your target is late at night. You're targeting single people. You're targeting poor people. You are allowed to show on television somebody putting their chips on a number and it coming up and getting huge profit. You know, this is drug dealing. That's what it is, pure and simple. It is every inch as immoral as selling dangerous drugs to children on street corners. So, and this has been permitted by, you know, and then encouraged by a succession of British governments of both, you know, both sides of the divide.
Do you think it's enough then, limiting it to £50? Do they just need to go?
I get Ray Winston's army of millions. I give all of them a baseball bat and I say, go in there and smash the bloody things to destruction. These things have no business on a high street. You know, and God knows how many tens of thousands. And it's, of course, it's not just the people, you know, it has feeds into domestic violence and divorce and children going without school, you know, textbooks and clothes. You know, it's an insane policy. It's the most insane policy I've ever seen. And, you know, for 450 million a year or whatever it is, the Treasury gets.
It's not worth the social cost
of it.
That's
like 1.5 Typhoon fighter jets. It's just ridiculous. Make it stop.
Well, thank you for
joining us. And put Ray Winston in the stocks.
Thank you for joining us today, Matthew.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you for listening. Please rate, review and subscribe on iTunes, Acast or wherever else you get your podcasts. Helen Hodnott produced this episode. I'm Kirsty Major. See you next week.